Hello, sex fans. Welcome back. Today is Wednesday, April 15th, 2009, and you are lucky enough to be listening to the podcast edition of Dr. Dick's Sex Advice with an Edge. And I'm your host, that savagely scintillating sexologist, Dr. Dick.
You're a dull boy, dull as plain song, la la la, forever on one note. I gave the church up out of boredom. I can do as much for you.
Mother, I told you, if you're going to be part of the audience, you have to sit there and be quiet. We're back today with my guest Max, the Seattle-based bondage artist, educator, and dom. This is part two of our chat in this podcast series called Sex Edge-ucation. As you know, this series is all about the world of fetish sex, kink, and alternative lifestyles. Max and I will be exploring all sorts of interesting topics, not least among them is his polyamorous life with Mistress Matisse and the oh-so-charming Lorelei. If you somehow missed part one of our conversation, look for last week's podcast, number 113, on Dr. Dick's podcast page at the top of drdicksexadvice.com. Or simply use my site's search function. Type in podcast number 113. Don't forget to include the pound sign. Just a quick aside. As most of you know, I was one of the many presenters at the Seattle Fetish and Fantasy Festival this past weekend. When I wasn't teaching, I had the opportunity to sit in on a couple of other fine workshops offered by some of the Northwest's most illustrious kink educators. And I'm here to tell you, as delightful and informative as Max is in this podcast conversation, this medium does not compare to Max in front of a live audience with a length of rope in one hand and the beautiful Lorelei in the other. They are phenomenal together and not to be missed. Be sure to visit Max online at his site, bondagelessons.com. Today's podcast sponsor is fetishmovies.com. So let's just say that you've met the person of your dreams, only you haven't got the nerve to tell your new honey your dirty little secret. The sweet thing hasn't a clue that you're itching for some big-time bondage, or that you'd sell your soul to be dominated like the scum that you are, or you're salivating over that dildo you have tucked away in the attic, the one that could be mistaken for a floor lamp, or you're craving to be spanked till your shameless ass glows in the dark, or you want to hump your partner's feet like a dog and gobble up his or her toe jam, or you have a nasty little thing for spike heels, frilly knickers, and jungle red lipstick.
I'm sorry you're not fonder of me, lad. Your father always said be fond of stronger men.
Exactly. Well then, I have just the thing for you. Take your new friend on a little tour of fetishmovies.com. You'll find absolutely every kink and fetish represented in this treasure trove of decidedly unvanilla programming. Fetishmovies.com is the ideal place to learn about or just enjoy all that is nasty in sex. And here's a little tip. Just for creating an account, you get 10 minutes of smutty viewing absolutely free. Why, you can't beat that with a stick. Look for the fetishmovies.com banner right there in the sidebar of drdicksexadvice.com. Okay, on with the show.
Hey, Max. Thanks again for joining us. I'd like to pick up where we left off last week, and let's talk about the role of endorphins and adrenaline in power play. What do you have to say?
Ooh, lots. And again, thanks for having me back, Richard. It's great to be here again. So I think as we wrapped up our discussion last week, we were sort of talking about different motivations for doing BDSM, ranging from aesthetic to relationship deepening to all kinds of stuff. From the perspective of the bottom, two of the common motivations are delightfully physiological, and they have to do with endorphins and with adrenaline. And let's talk about adrenaline kinds of play first for a second, because it's the one that I think people are most familiar with.
Uh-huh.
Adrenaline, of course, is the old fight or flight thing. It's the thing that gets your heart up and changes your breathing, and it's the response to danger or fear, typically, or being startled. It's the stuff that makes middle-aged moms lift up cars to get the kids out from underneath and all that kind of stuff.
Or ski down a slope that you weren't prepared to ski down before.
Exactly. So adrenaline is about preparing the body for fight or flight, and it's a fun thing to play with. And the kinds of play that get there are play that's based on being startled or being afraid, grabbing somebody by the back of the head and jerking them around and slapping around in sudden ways will tend to provoke that kind of adrenaline response. Lots of tops like the physicality of that, they like that response. Lots of bottoms like that response also. Sort of at the other end of the spectrum is an endorphin response. Endorphins are natural opiates that the body produces to mask pain, basically. So while the adrenaline response is, you know, I just heard a bear at the mouth of a cave, and I either need to get a stick and hit it or run away, the endorphin response is the bear has bitten me, and I'm bleeding, and I need to be able to put that pain and that physical damage to the side so I can do whatever I need to do, like run away or fight the bear or get my kids out of the way or something.
Interesting.
So endorphins, adrenaline is that heart-pounding, narrow-focused, you know, oh my God, I have to do something thing. Endorphins really are a warm, fuzzy sense of well-being is once you get there. It is an opiate. It's related to the opiate family, even though it's legal and chemically produced in your own body. So
if we could outlaw it, we would.
We probably would, which is sad in another whole conversation. So endorphins can be produced by typically sort of regular and predictable physical sensation. So a long sustained spanking will usually produce an endorphin response, as opposed to hitting somebody once abruptly will usually produce an adrenaline response.
Interesting.
Flogging, sort of lots of intense sensation, which is what we BDSM people call pain, intense sensation, will produce an endorphin response. Mm-hmm. And I would say more people like endorphin responses than adrenaline responses, actually. It's a very common and popular kind of play.
Yeah.
Adrenaline is interesting in that everybody produces an adrenaline response pretty easily. I mean, if you walk up to somebody behind them and shout at them, you can pretty much get an adrenaline response.
Yeah.
Endorphin responses often are a little bit learned. It's not uncommon for a bottom to need to spend some time playing and sort of exploring all of that to kind of find the pathway that in their head produces them that endorphin response. And then in my experience, once a person finds that, it's pretty repeatable.
So a person can actually learn how to trigger that or access that inside their body?
Yeah, I said learn, and I think access is a better word, because it's not, I'm not sure it's anything I can really teach a person. I wish I could, because, mm-hmm. Ooh, there's a market for that.
Yeah.
Some people
wouldn't
struggle finding it. Yeah.
Right.
But people often draw on other skills they have, whether it's tantra or yoga or meditation, mm-hmm. or...
Right.
But it's interesting watching people who are often new, who get spanked or flogged or some kind of sort of physical activity like that, who say, well, that was nice, it felt like a nice massage, but what is this floaty thing people talk about? And then one day they go, oh my God, that was it, and that was really wonderful,
yeah.
And I liked it, and I want that again.
Yeah. So there's a rush, there's a high for both the participants, the top and the bottom? Different ones, I would suspect?
There is a high for the bottom that's obvious and, you know, physiologically based, if you
right.
will. There's certainly a high for the top, too, that's part sort of contact high. It's
yeah.
a, you know, second-hand kind of thing.
Right.
And part first-hand. I mean, certainly the adrenaline one, again, is perhaps easier to understand if you are doing a takedown scene where you're wrestling somebody to the ground and handcuffing them,
mm-hmm.
there's going to be a lot of adrenaline there for both
mm-hmm.
people.
Right.
The endorphin thing also is a little bit contagious in a, I think, more subtle but delightful way also. And it's fun sometimes. One of the classic endorphin responses is people's pupils will dilate. And so you
mm-hmm.
look at somebody and their eyes are like enormous. And
mm-hmm.
you look around and you say, the room isn't really that dark. And your eyes look like you're in a cave. And
uh-huh.
what's going on here?
Uh-huh.
And it's fun sometimes to get to the end of a scene and not only look at your bottom
uh-huh.
and say, ooh, you're really high, aren't you? But to go look in a mirror and say, ooh,
yeah.
maybe I'm a little fucked up myself. because it's a delightful state.
Uh-huh.
One of the interesting things about tapping is depending on for myself at least, speaking for myself here, depending on what you're doing, if what you're doing is technically demanding or dangerous, you really can't allow yourself to get too fucked up and too high mm-hmm. while you're doing it.
Right.
So if I'm doing a rope suspension scene, you know, in an elevator shaft 50 feet above a floor, I really need to be pretty present and pretty intellectual and pretty aware,
yeah.
even though my bottom may be allowed to get
zoned
all fucked up and zoned out.
Right.
So what will happen for me, and again, some of this is based on just a lot of years of doing it, is I'll be really attentive and very left brain and very focused while I'm doing that. We'll sort of get to a point of safety and near completion, you know, I've let them down on the floor or whatever, and then I get fucked up.
Right.
Because if you don't get a little bit high yourself, it's easy to kind of get some sense of resentment where
yeah.
you put all this work into
right.
a scene and then you go, wait, the bottom got all the good stuff.
Yeah.
Last week you said something that was so insightful, and that is that the reward for the top may often be that sense of mastery, that, you know, looking at something well done and I've achieved that, and, you know, I did what I wanted to do. I've raised myself up to this position.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a reward in itself, it would seem to me.
Absolutely. And in fact, one of the reasons that people play in public is to be able to display that. I mean, it's certainly generally tacky and unpleasant to have that be the only reason to play in public, is to show off to the other people in the room, but clearly that's a motivation for exhibiting your skill in a setting that isn't just in your basement dungeon at home.
Well, I mean, since this is an art form, and I do believe it's an art form, you know, exhibiting one's art is so much different than sitting at home and painting.
Absolutely.
You know,
absolutely.
Painting at home is a wonderful cathartic kind of thing, but bringing that your painting to a gallery and letting people walk past it and ooh and ah or ooh and ah is something quite different, it would seem to me.
That is a great analogy, and I just wrote down that and would love to use that.
Steal that. Steal that with Dr.
That
Dick.
Course, but, no, that's very powerful.
Good. I would like to, you know, move on from what we just talked about, endorphins and adrenaline, to talk about BDSM in terms of recreation and catharsis. First of all, you agree that there are at least these two aspects of power play?
Absolutely.
Could you elaborate a bit?
I can, and in fact, I might push back a smidge on the word power play.
Okay.
So let me start there, if I may.
Good.
And this is where my geeky left side comes out a little bit. But if we had a video camera going instead of just audio here, I would pull out a flip chart and I'd draw a picture here. So let me verbally draw a picture, and it's a graph with two axes, and one axis is a DS axis. It's dominance and submission, and it's about power play.
Uh-huh.
And on one side of that is the, you know, master domly dom in charge of everything and in charge of you all the time. And on the other side is the, you know, I want to be a slave and I want to be controlled and I want to be told what to do. And then there's a different axis which is about physical sensation. That's the sadistic, masochistic axis.
Uh-huh.
And it's about people who like to deliver sensation or people who like to receive sensation. So again, that might be spanking, it might be a needle, it might be the feeling of rope around a person.
E-stim.
Exactly. It might be electrical stimulation. Yep. There's lots of modalities for delivering that. And again, when we're talking to community colleges or sort of vanilla groups, we call this delivering sensation. When we're talking among ourselves, we call this pain and hurting people. So there's a DS scale and there's a SM scale, if you
uh-huh.
will. And people can be sort of anywhere around both of those scales,
uh-huh.
and they can combine them in any reasonable way. When I think power play, I think DS. I think something where we've deliberately agreed to change the balance of power. Lots of people do physical play where they do a spanking or a flogging or whatever, where they actually don't change the power dynamic.
Uh-huh.
And in fact, there are people who are very toppy in terms of DS who want to be in charge, who say, okay, I want you to flog me because I like the way it feels,
uh-huh.
and I want you to hit me right here like that. And that's not a submissive act,
no.
but it's a masochistic act.
Right, got it.
So sort of playing with the terminology there a little bit.
Right.
That's very helpful, by the way, because it really underscores how really complex this is as an issue, but it also underscores how complex we are as humans about what it is that we want and need and how we go about getting what we want and what we need.
Absolutely. And one of the cool things about all of this for me is that if you have any commitment at all to doing this, it means you have to be thoughtful about what you want and what you like, and then pursue it. And
you have to tell someone.
And you have to communicate
it.
And it's really easy. I mean, God knows any kind of sexual activity works better with communication, but there's actually a pretty good baseline of sex, general sex, that you can do without being very thoughtful and very communicative. Mm-hmm. It's pretty hard to do really any level of BDSM without being communicative, because it's really just not appropriate to walk up and start hitting somebody without a discussion first.
Right. Yeah, because the cathartic and the recreational aspects, I've been mentioning this in the other interviews that I've been doing, is that I do massage and body work,
mm-hmm.
and most people come to massage and body work for the pleasure. But I've also realized that on some occasions, people, when I'm working on their back or something like that, they have a cathartic moment. They let go of sadness or anger or fear or abusive memories and things like that, and you start weeping and carrying on. And it's not because my work is bad, but that something working on their body triggered this release, and
mm-hmm.
it's really honored. First of all, when it first happened to me, I was taken aback. I wasn't prepared. I didn't realize that
yep.
This I was accessing this.
Could be a little frustrating
in this other, it certainly can. And it wasn't until afterwards, until like a debriefing session after the massage, where I said, "Well, what happened there?" And I was working on somebody who had recently lost his lover. Didn't lose him, he died, and he was grieving and had really no time to grieve, doing all the proper cultural grieving kinds of things, but no personal grieving. And this was the release that he was looking for. It was a brilliant moment, and I was so honored to be present to that. Do you play with both women and men?
I do. I would say that I play more with women than men, which is more about opportunity and the way I tend to present in the world.
Uh-huh.
I love playing with men. It's often
who doesn't?
It's often a very different experience for me. And some of that is about sort of the physicality of how male physiques are often different than female physiques,
mm-hmm.
and some of it is about just the way men approach sexuality and
right.
body contact and
right,
stuff.
Right,
I think.
Right. Yeah. Is it safe to assume that you don't play with every Tom, Dick, or Mary who approaches you? And if so, how do you discern between the ones that you encourage and the ones that you discourage?
It is safe to assume that, and there's been an evolution, sort of an evolution in my style there. Lots of us, I think, approach sexuality and play, which is in some ways an extension of sexuality, from kind of a scarcity perspective, and I think especially men... and perhaps especially straight men, and I'm basically a straight man in a sort of an odd way. But lots of us sort of start out with, oh my gosh, I can't get any, and pretty much any opportunity is there to be taken. And,
uh-huh.
you look at college men, and that's pretty much the way it all works, I think.
Great.
I'm pleased to be at a point in my life where I actually have lots of opportunities, and that's a healthy place to be, and it's healthy to be a little more critical about which of those opportunities you decide to take, I think. In terms of approaching me, what melts my butter and what makes me actually think about is this somebody I would like to play with,
uh-huh.
is whether they show up with some level of, an air of respect, if you will, which is not about DS, it's about I'm a human being and I deserve to be approached as a human being. I preserve, and I'm not a topping machine.
Mm-hmm.
And there are people who will sort of approach tops, particularly tops who are well known in a community, as if they're really topping machines, and you can put a quarter in and
mm-hmm.
say, I'd like to be flogged. I see you do flogging. Here's a quarter. Please flog me.
Right.
And it's not to say these relationships aren't partly transactional in some ways, but it's we like to believe they're not that transactional and that superficial, I think.
I mean, besides, you have a wealth of information. You are a wise man and with lots of experience. That should be acknowledged, it would seem to me, and just the way that someone, you know, approaches you for service or for even information in a respectful sort of way. Unfortunately, I think in our culture, we, you know, short circuit that, you know, I mean, master means virtually nothing these days, which is unfortunate, but there you go.
There's a great story about, I wish this was my own story, and it's actually Mr. Matisse's story, but let me tell it because it's so good about approaching a top, particularly a top who, particularly in a DS or a service way, in addition to just, I want this physical activity. Matisse was teaching a workshop at Babeland, I don't know, 6-8 years ago now, and one of the staff members who was also sort of a budding kinky BOI boy, sort of a F to M, approached her and said to her, we'd like to get you a beverage, of course, and I've done a little bit of research on you because I talked to somebody else that I know that you're a partner with, and I know that you prefer Pepsi to Coke. And in fact, I heard that you like Diet Pepsi, but what I don't know is whether you like it in a can or a bottle. And so I went out and I got both.
Wow.
And it's just hard for me as a top who likes service and who likes power dynamics not to respond to that kind of an approach.
Really?
Because what that tells me is here's somebody who has done a little bit of research and a little bit of thought about their own kink and their own sexuality and what they like.
Uh-huh.
They've taken the trouble to do a little bit of research about me,
mm-hmm.
And they have approached me in a way that makes me feel that they not only want something for themselves, but that they would like to give me something as part of that exchange,
right.
As opposed to,
right.
Hi, it's me, and I want an experience, and I want you to give it to me.
Right. In the time that we have left, I would really like to at least begin the discussion. Maybe we could carry this on, you know, at another time. But since we've alluded both this week and last to the issue of polyamory, and that you are a proud polyamorist, can you tell us a little bit about that? This would be the first time my audience is being introduced to this particular lifestyle. So anything that you think we ought to know from the get-go would be a good thing.
I'd love to do that. Thanks. And poly is in many ways just as important to me as kink. And,
yes, I hear that.
And there's a lot of overlap there in the poly and the kinky communities, which is, I'm not sure I can explain that, but there seems to be a handful of things that go together, like poly kink and science fiction conventions or something.
And Darth Vader.
Matisse's ringtone for me is the Darth Vader Imperial March, in fact, which I'm kind of embarrassed by, but sort of oddly pleased by. Anyway, poly, the way I would define it and the way most people would define it is a practice of carrying on multiple concurrent relationships in a fashion where all the people involved have knowledge of those relationships and have consented to that kind of a lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
So it's distinctly different from having an affair where the people you're involved with don't know that you have multiple relationships.
Or even fuck buddies.
It's usually different from fuck buddies or swinging,
right.
In that the presumption with poly, again, there's lots of argument about definitions here, but the presumption usually is there's an emotional content here of some kind. And that can range from, we had a really nice experience and I'd like to see more of you sometime in some kind of unspecified way, to I have two life partners.
Yes.
So there's a tremendous range there, but the assumption usually is there is some entanglement of each other's lives and emotions and, you know, planning for the future and all of that, a little bit more than fuck buddies or a date or a swing encounter or something
right.
like that. Yeah.
So this This means more in terms of commitment then too. Do you live with your partners, both of them, or one of them even?
Yes and no. I live with one of them. Matisse and I cohabitate. We have a house together. We've been living together for quite a few years now. I really have what I would identify as three primary partners, probably, despite my website, which is out of date.
Whoops. Quick, folks!
You never read that stuff. I have another partner who I see 3-4 times a week. We spend a bunch of nights together. We do a lot of things together. I would say we are life partners in a sense that way. We do not cohabitate. I have a third partner that I see once a week, every couple of weeks. It's a multi-year relationship now. It's deep and significant that way. But the level of time that we are able to allocate to each other is much less, is probably the best way to say that.
So would there be a distinction made between polyamory and, let's say, multiple marriage polygamy?
Yes, although again, everybody would argue about the distinction. I'd say the difference between poly and multiple marriage may be as simple as one's codified and, you know, it's in theory legal or sanctified
in some fashion.
And the other isn't. There's so many ways to do poly. It's kind of considered to be, in fact, polyamory is sort of the full word there. It's considered to be almost an umbrella word. There are people who talk about polyfidelity, meaning they are faithful but to more than one person, so they may have a 3 or 4 way relationship, but they do not have sexual relations or maybe even emotional relations outside of that. There are people who talk about fluid bonding but not emotional relationships. There are people who talk about households and cohabitation and sort of define their poly in terms of the four of us live together or the three of us live together. As you heard, I live with one of my partners, but I consider myself significantly bonded to the others also, even though we don't live together. And then, interestingly for me, because so much of my BDSM is about intimate relationships with people, I mean, that is the raison d'etre for my BDSM, I consider a number of my BDSM partners to be parts of my poly family, if you will, even though there's nothing that looks like classical genital sex going on there.
So, is your poly life, are you the center of your poly life, and would, say, Matisse be the center of a different poly life, or one of your other partners? Are you satellite partnered for, I don't even know how to ask this question exactly. But I know you're talking from your own experience, and that's what I was looking for. So I don't know. Could you say more if you have more to say?
I could. I think I know the question. And while we just don't have language for this stuff very well,
which is
hard.
Yeah.
Which is one of the hard things about doing it. In fact, is you kind of have to invent a lot of the concepts as you're trying to work out problems with people. Certainly my poly relationships, I am the center of them because, of course, I'm the center of everything in my world.
Yay!
My experience has been not everyone views me as the center of their world, and I'm working on that. The best way to sort of talk about poly structures, I think, is sort of graphically again. So let's simplify my poly world for a minute and say it's me plus two partners. It's me and a second partner. One way to view that would be as a V, where I have a relationship with person A and a relationship with person B, which is in fact the way we structure it. My two partners do not really have relationships with each other.
I see.
Yet.
Interesting. That was my next question. Good.
They are friends. We are often together. We go out to dinner together. Sometimes there is not a sexual or really an emotional relationship there, other than they're good friends. And they share the bond of being close to me. So, you know, certainly it's delightful to watch, you know, for instance, somebody sort of attack me in some setting and watch the two of them sort of growl and bristle and, you know, join forces in that kind of context. But that's because of their loving response about me. But they are not partners. We don't all sleep together. So there's a V shape. Now we add to that V that Matisse, for instance, has another partner herself, Monk of TwistedMonk.com, the rope manufacturer. So if I were sitting here and I were channeling Mistress Matisse, I would say I have a V relationship. It's Monk on one side of the V and Max on the other side. Monk and I are friends. We have some business relationships. We have personal relationships. We're not lovers. We don't sleep in the same bed as Matisse and do double penetrations. So kind of what you get there is you get the Matisse V and the Max V, and if you put them together, you get a W, right? You get Monk to Matisse, to me, to my other partner, Lorelei. And then, of course, there's my third partner, so we could draw another leg of that thing here. Right. So what you get is these very complicated pictures with dots and lines and what the relationships are, and then you get into solid lines and dotted lines and circles.
And it's three-dimensional as opposed to, you know, two-dimensional, it would seem to me. I mean, if you were, I was trying to visualize that as you were talking about it, and it looks alive. It looks like it has a shape as opposed to what I don't think most people in traditional monogamous or sexually exclusive relationships would necessarily. You know, it seems to be flat. Not there's anything wrong with that necessarily. It's just that it's not as dynamic.
I agree. It's not as dynamic, and it's not as presuming that traditional relationship is as traditional as it looks from the outside. There's kind of nothing to talk about because it's like, well, yep, I'm married.
Yeah,
that's the relationship.
Most people, again, are going to find in my audience are going to find it difficult to wrap their head around this because they struggle with issues like jealousy and stuff like that in a sexually exclusive or a monogamous relationship, and you know the concept of you know adding personalities, different personalities to this mixture, is mind blowing. I tend not to think that way because I've had experience like that in my previous life or earlier in my life, but what does one do with jealousy? Is this stuff that you just learn to deal with in an effective sort of way, or does your kink background give you the tools that you need to navigate this even better?
Well, it's really challenging. I mean, I think anybody who tells you jealousy is not an issue is not paying attention or lying.
Yeah.
Having said that, it's absolutely manageable, I think, and all of this is about communication, and any relationship is challenging and requires a lot of communication and occasional soul searching and all of that. Poly is the same thing, only lots more so, and it's much more challenging just because you have more moving parts, and there are new pressures, I think, that happen there. Jealousy, the biggest way, I think there are two ways that I personally have found to deal with jealousy well. One of them is to watch my partners and their response to my other partners.
Uh-huh.
And despite the fact that Matisse started out actually with vastly more sexual and poly experience than I did, even though I'm older than she is, when she and I hooked up, she was in a point of sort of a low point in her polyness, if you will. She was just busy doing other stuff. She was doing a lot of writing and she was doing photography and she just didn't have the energy and the time for multiple relationships. And I did. So I was sort of poly and she wasn't, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And she accepted that with just a tremendous amount of grace and stability. So fast forward a little bit to the point where Matisse says, okay, I'm going to take on some other partners now. It was really difficult for me not to look at her example and say, well, I would really be just a jerk to be responding badly to this, wouldn't I? Which doesn't mean I didn't respond badly a few times, but in the back of my mind is always the, okay, Max, take a deep breath. You've had 2 years of this where Matisse has been nothing but good to you. How can you not do that back?
Right.
Some of that just gets to a word called compersion, which is about being able to take pleasure in your partner being happy. And we kind of get wrapped up with, if I'm in a partnership, everything we do, we have to do together, and there's this great romantic notion of we hold hands and walk off into the sunset, nobody else matters. In point of fact, hopefully all of us learn to take pleasure from multiple sources.
Mm-hmm.
And if you really love somebody, it's reasonable to think that you would want them to get as much pleasure and as many good things in their life as possible. And if
right.
one of those things
right.
isn't you, okay.
And I mean, who among us can fulfill the needs, all the needs of another individual? I mean, it's just, it's impossible. I mean, it's curious to me because I see this so much when I'm doing therapy, and you know, couples come in and because they're broken or their marriage is in disarray, and oftentimes it's a question of, you know, he's been unfaithful or she's been unfaithful, and I said, what does that mean? And, well, he or she has had an affair, and I said, is fidelity really an issue of genitals? And I don't think so. I think fidelity is so much bigger than that. And I said, you know, you allow your partner, you know, your husband, your wife, your partner, whomever, to go to dinner with other people, they can eat with other people, they can, you know, go to the gym with other people, they can go to the museum, they can go to a gallery with other people, they can go running with other people, they can sometimes even go on vacation with other people. What makes you think, you know, that, you know, adding sexuality to that, or sexual expression, or even like a kink expression of themselves is somehow a violation? And so it's relearning all of these kinds
it
of
is.
Things, it seems to me.
And it's really challenging. I mean, it's really tremendously rewarding. I mean, I think of all the wonderful things I've gotten from any of the relationships I've had, and then you say, wow, you have two relationships.
Yeah.
You get twice as much, and that's true, but it's hard.
And there's nothing in the popular culture that is supporting you. I mean, there's nobody out there saying, hip, hip, hooray for you, and, you know, here's the support group, and, you know, and this is how you raise your kids, and this is, you know, how you... There's nothing.
There's a lot of trailblazing.
Right.
There's probably one other thing I'd like to go back to about sort of jealousy and managing responses to being in a poly relationship, and that is so much of the problem in poly relationships is fear-based, really.
Right.
And kind of the bottom line is, well, it masks is a lot of other stuff. The bottom line is, I'm afraid of loss. I'm afraid I'm going to lose my partner because she's in love with this other person,
right.
or he's in love with this other person. And for me, the most powerful thing there, I actually really learned from Matisse, and it's just sort of taking a breath and saying, okay, well, what's happening right now?
Yes.
And what's happening right now is I'm in love, I have multiple partners, my partners have multiple partners, and it's all working, and...
It's remarkably stable.
And I shouldn't be conjuring up a fear of what might happen when
right.
there's actually no evidence that it is or will happen. But that's hard to do. I mean, that's easy to say. It's really hard to do.
It's most assuredly that. Good. Well, that consumes all of our time, and possibly more than all of our time. I want to thank you for being so open and so present and so available to me and my audience for these 2 weeks. Before we go, could you give us your website address again and walk us around?
I sure could. And thank you again, Richard. This has just been a pleasure both times. The website again is bondagelessons.com. It's a whole bunch of BDSM and poly and BDSM relationship education. The website is full of dry stuff like scheduling information for workshops and how to contact me to set up private instruction or coaching.
Good. Thanks, Max. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Richard, and I look forward to doing this again sometime.
Good. I hope so.
Alrighty.
Bye now.
What an amazing show, huh? Tune in next week for more Sex Advice with an Edge with your host, me, Dr. Dick. Again, this week's podcast sponsor is fetishmovies.com. Listen up, sex fans. Dr. Dick has heard it all a million times. Some sorry perverts got it bad for white bread. Dear Dr. Dick, help! I'm in love with the sweetest guy or gal in the world, but our sex life is all vanilla all the time. I'm bored shitless. I know how to liven things up, you see. I have this fetish, but I don't know how to tell my partner about it. And I'm afraid that if I tell my partner, he or she will freak. What's a perv to do? Well, introducing your partner to your personal world of kink is tricky. The whole little love match could blow up in your face, don't you know? But a life of pretense and sexual boredom isn't the way to go either. Why not just stand tall, like the disgusting pervert you are, and introduce your partner to your fetish by way of fetishmovies.com? After all, unless your boyfriend or gal pal is as dumb as a post, she will have already figured out that your mutual sex life limps. Besides, there's nothing more satisfying than corrupting an innocent. Who knows? Your partner may have kinky secrets of his own.
What's the official line on sodomy? How stands the crown on boys who do with boys?
Now you're getting the hang of it. Look for the fetishmovies.com banner right there in the sidebar of my site. And look for all of Dr. Dick's podcasts on iTunes. You'll find me in the podcast section under Health, subcategory Sexuality, or just search for Dr. Dick's Sex Advice. Don't forget to subscribe and leave a comment when you do. Until next week, remember, sex is good. And good sex? Why, that's even better. Over and out.